Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 4 years now since 9/11, the country reeled and raged after those attacks. It takes only a minute to remember how it felt.
The World Trade Center, Tower number 1, is on fire. The whole outside of the building was just a huge explosion.
At the Pentagon, a plane or a helicopter has crashed, apparently as part of whatever this operation has been. A cascade of sparks and fire. That is about as frightening a scene as you will ever see.
Center, we heard a big bang, and then we saw smoke coming out, and everybody started running out, and we saw the plane on the other side of the building, and there was smoke everywhere, and people were jumping out the windows.
Today, our fellow citizens, our way of life, our very freedom came under attack in a series of deliberate and deadly terrorist acts.
4 years, President Bush rallied the nation. There was unity and Afghanistan. Then Iraq and mission not yet accomplished and disunity. Then Cindy Sheehan and high oil and Katrina. And suddenly, it's not at all clear whether America is safer, is better off than it was on that horrible day 4 years ago. We are on a journey. Where is it taking us? This hour on Point, novelist Tom Wolfe and security big thinker Zbigniew Brzezinski on American security and American culture 4 years after 9/11. You can join the conversation. How are we handling this acid test of national wisdom and character? Does America still have the right stuff? And are we acting on it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Zbigniew Brzezinski, National Security Advisor under President Jimmy Carter, former Director of the Trilateral Commission, now Professor of American Foreign Policy at Johns Hopkins University, and author most recently of The Choice, Global Domination or Global Leadership. Mr. Brzezinski, thanks for being with us this morning.
Good to be with you.
Also with us from New York is the author, novelist, and social observer Tom Wolfe, author of, among many others, The Right Stuff, The Bonfire of the Vanities, A Man in Full, and I Am Charlotte Simmons. Tom Wolfe, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Zbigniew Brzezinski, first to you, if I may. It seems like a long arc we've traveled in these last 4 years. You write rather critically where we've arrived. You describe America as paranoid and a global pariah. Have I got that right? What's brought us to that point?
Well, these are strong words, obviously, so one has to be prepared to defend them, and it's painful to do so. But the fact is that we have become a fear-driven nation, and we have become preoccupied with our insecurity to a point to which it is beginning to affect the quality of American life. And abroad, our leadership is suspect. Our credibility is close to nil, and our ability to forge genuine coalitions for human progress, for security, for greater justice, is very much reduced. So it's not a very attractive picture.
Tom Wolfe, you have been sort of sympathetic to the conservative thrum of American life at large in the country and saying, look, the country's getting its moral fiber knit back together here. It's not knocked so far back. Pull up your socks, folks, and let's go. How do you see these last 4 years and where it's taken us?
Well, you know, I hesitate to strike up an argument with this big whose background is so great and which I'm in awe of, but I have to say that I agree with the last part of his statement about the our declining prestige in the rest of the world, most of which I think has to do with what Jean-Francois Revel called wounded chauvinism. The French have been suffering from wounded chauvinism since 1870. But anyway, the first part about a national mood of despair, I would dispute that. I mean, as a national mood of despair around the kind of dinner tables that Zbig and I are apt to eat. Mm. I remember when Tina Brown, I love Tina Brown's work. I think she's terrific, and I like her personally. But she described in one of her columns a dinner in which everybody was, all media folks were talking about, you know, what can we do about George Bush? As the dessert was being served, suddenly the waiter said, hadn't spoken a word the entire dinner. He says, "Well, I live in the suburbs, and I'm voting for Bush." And I think this really kind of ignoring of the spirit of people in most of the United States is not a good thing to allow to happen. I was in Bristol, Tennessee, two Saturdays ago. Mm. For the Bristol 500, it was a NASCAR stock car race, and I can't claim to have talked to all the 165,000 people who were there, but I just judging from their reaction to things said before the races, I simply can't agree that there's any national mood of despair or paranoia or anything.
Tom Wolfe, let me ask you. You feel this kind of bedrock confidence, and the waiter's decision about what to do with George Bush was not so difficult. He was going to vote for them, and no doubt did. Is that necessarily in contradiction with what Zbigniew Brzezinski is describing here? There's an inside game and an outside game, and it's part of what makes this conversation so interesting. You're the master of the inside, though you've spoken to the outside, and we'll talk to that. But does that political support that George Bush has garnered, and we saw it, he took the White House last fall, does that somehow mean that we are necessarily on the right track under his leadership abroad?
No, it doesn't, because that becomes a judgment that history will eventually make. But it does mean that, I think, that this is not a nation in despair. I mean, when you look at it, the 2004 results and the 2000 results before 9/11 were identical. It just happened to be a different state that was up for grabs at the very end.
Ohio Florida. Instead of Florida, and off we go.
And the rest of the map was the same. You'd think that if there was been some great shift in national consciousness, that there would have been turbulence in those results. I mean, it was like buying a Rand McNally Atlas from 1995 and comparing it to 2005. There isn't much difference.
Well, let me get into this.
Yes, please.
And I think the audience should know in that we're both kind of, I think, mutual admirers, because Tom said something very nice about me, and I have to say that I consider him to be the best novelist, the one I enjoy the most, and a great social satirist.
I'm going to retire right now.
Let me immediately say that. I really
duly
like
mutually noted.
Tom Wolfe and his creativity. But a further point. First of all, I didn't say it was a mood of despair. I didn't even use the word despair. I said this is becoming a fear-driven country. And it is. Look, we're passing the Patriot Act. Look at some of the provisions of the Patriot Act. They're based on fear. American citizens means Tom, you.
Yes.
Means me. Mm. We can be arrested and held indefinitely. Because somebody somewhere in the FBI or in the Homeland Security or in the military decides that we're hostile. I mean, this is absolutely appalling. Look at some of the provisions of the Patriot Act. They really do infringe on civil rights. Why? Because of fear. Look at the extraordinary concerns we have about our security, which public opinion polls sustain. Yes, maybe the people at the NASCAR events were cheerful because they were being entertained, and maybe the waiter was feeling good because he's moved up to the suburbs. But public opinion polls show fear about security, more pessimism about the future, real pessimism about the future, and increasingly profound doubts about President Bush's leadership. So we're not talking about despair, but we are talking about a country that's becoming troubled.
And yet, President Bush...
that, abroad, people no longer like America. I mean, that is an established fact. For the first time in our history, America as a polity, as a country with policies, not Americans as a society, but America as an actor on the world scene, is actually almost universally disliked. That's terrible.
Tom Wolf, does that matter to you? Is that just wounded French chauvinism get lost, or does it matter?
Well, I think a good bit of it is wounded chauvinism. I mean, there are certainly so many people in not only France, but England, and probably Germany, dying for a reason to hate the United States. But let's put that aside for the second, because I don't think I think as big as absolutely right. We are under attack politically all over the probably all over the world. But let's get back to the Patriot Act for a second. The Patriot Act was in response to something that had never before happened in world history, namely a group of guerrillas, as we say in English, mounting an attack of the magnitude of 9/11, attacking a metropolis and destroying the two largest buildings in that metropolis, and seemingly coming from out of nowhere, as far as most Americans knew. And I think it shook up the government also to the point where they said, well, we must take some extraordinary measures. I think it was a jurist who said the Constitution is not a suicide pact. But this was, I'm also happy. I really love the way this country works. Immediately, there was a counterforce against the Patriot Act, in which said, you can't go this far. And as a result, I think there's been very, very little abuse of the powers of the Patriot Act.
Right there, and you're finding a balance that we've got to take a short break. We are talking this hour with novelist Tom Wolf and security chieftain Zbigniew Brzezinski about America and American foreign policy 4 years after 9/11. You can join us. Are we safer, better off than we were 4 years ago? And with 4 years now to reflect, to react, has 9/11 brought out the best, the worst, a combination in Americans? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist Tom Wolf and security chieftain Zbigniew Brzezinski about America 4 years after 9/11. You can join the conversation. How are we doing with this acid test? Does America still have the right stuff? Do you see the America Brzezinski describes, paranoid pariah? Do you see Tom Wolf's America re-knitting its moral base, undaunted by challenge? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, and there's so much I want to get into. Zbigniew Brzezinski, Tom Wolf says, the U.S. Constitution, after all, my friend, is not a suicide pact. You have been writing very recently about what you call, or quoting Arnold Toynbee, the great historian, suicidal statecraft. You're both referencing suicide. What's your reference to Mr. Brzezinski?
The growing isolation of the United States and intensifying hostility towards American policies, which are, I think, posing a longer-term threat to the United States. But let me sort of stress something else. When Tom says that the Patriot Act was produced by what happened on 9/11, I fully agree with that. That explains why the Patriot Act arose. But it doesn't justify the rationality of all of the measures adopted, including the Patriot Act. The fact of the matter is that in spite of the Patriot Act, we have not convicted anyone in this country of any really serious terrorist plot. So the Patriot Act has not been particularly helpful in uncovering terrorism. At the same time, we do know of quite a few cases of very severe civil rights abuses, which are part of a larger parcel of responses, of which Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib are a part, and all of that is creating a tremendously negative image for America. And on top of it, we're excluding foreign students from the United States, which is really damaging to us in our terms of our future. We're excluding scholars, medical personnel. And last but not least, and that's my last point, while the world, you know, was shocked, and we were shocked by the attack on 9/11, the fact of the matter is there was an enormous terrorist plot in Japan some years earlier to poison the Japanese subway networks.
Right.
12,000 people wounded, the sarin attack. Mm. The Japanese didn't go bananas. The British have been under attack for a number of years. London was bombed many times, 300 people killed in London. The Queen's favored uncle was killed. They didn't pass laws like the Patriot Act. My point is proportionality of response is what is needed. And one should not overreact because that's counterproductive. It's creating what I call a fearful nation, a fear-driven nation. I don't call it paranoid. And it's isolating us internationally.
Tom Wolfe, I wish you'd speak to that. And we've got you here. You're the novelist. You're the close social observer. You're the new journalist. You saw, we all did, the blow that the country took on 9/11. Take us into your sense of the American psyche, the kind of arc of response to that. I mean, in some sense, we are like a national single psyche, I suppose. It's some very meta sense. How do you describe the emotional reaction, the cycle we've been through?
Well, first let me say that the terrorist acts that Spig mentioned were all domestic in nature. The one that hit us was considered extremely sinister, inexplicable, the result of a kind of mentality that we have no understanding of. The Patriot Act was passed. It does make possible excessive restrictions on civil rights. But I don't know of a single arrest that has not been made with the belief that the person, a strong belief or indication that the person involved was not a closely tied to what happened at 9/11. I mean, I've not seen. Oh, I read the Chronicles of Higher Education every week. That's the kind of the trade magazine of universities.
Yeah.
And I'm keep looking. They're talking about the Patriot Act all the time, but I keep waiting for that first instance in which some librarian has been slapped in jail for not divulging who took out a book on Muslim fundamentalism. As far as I know, it just hasn't happened.
And yet we've got the ruling today on Jose Padilla saying American citizen can be held as he was without charge. You know, there's the controversy around the detainees in Guantanamo who have been found not to be involved, and they just can't figure out how to let them go.
Well, I mean, these are all people who were these cases go back almost to the month after 9/11, and there may be great injustices done there. I'm not disputing that, but it certainly has not been a case in which willy-nilly the government has been going around trying to suppress its critics by invoking the Patriot Act.
Tom Wolfe,
now, okay, if I can move to the second part.
Yes, please.
You mentioned and your question. What has been the national mood? Well, I was working on this book, I'm Charlotte Simmons, which is about college life. At the time 9/11 occurred, and I can tell you this with unfortunately great certainty, to most students, it was something that happened on television. It didn't disrupt their lives for a second, unless they were from New York City, like my daughter, who was extremely upset and immediately came to New York to see if she could help, and was outraged by the indifference of students around her. But this was not something that plunged people around America into despair, believe me.
But what do you take from that? And we've walked away from despair. Zbigniew says he never raised it. I didn't.
It wasn't a feeling of gloom and panic.
Fear, I think, is the operative word. Fear.
Fear did not sweep America, believe me.
But
you just go outside of New York City, you'll see that it didn't happen.
Let me ask you, in a lot of your books recently, including I Am Charlotte Simmons, you've got a kind of literary obsession and also reporters keen eye on Americans and their musculature. Charlie Croker in A Man in Full, talking about his, you know, in the opening page, fanning out his great latissimi dorsi. In the Bonfire of the Vanities, you've got your protagonist loving the fact that when he reached behind with one of his mighty arms, it made the widest muscles of his lats and fan out and practically split his shirt, his pectorals hardening into a couple of mountains of pure muscles. And we've had big displays of American power since 9/11. What do you make of that as a novelist?
Well, what you were mentioning, all of the lats, the traps, the pecs, the obliques, the quads.
You say Americans know the geography of their bodies better than the geography of the planet.
Right, better than the seven major planets. This is a current fashion. That's all it is. I go to the gym 6 days a week, attempting to make myself look intimidating. I find at the age of 75, it gets harder and harder to be intimidating.
That white suit is not enough anymore?
White suit just doesn't do it. Even if you pad it, it just doesn't do it. But it really is a fashion, and males have, since they've discovered that weightlifting is not really, it doesn't make you muscle-bound. And particularly in colleges, all sorts of boys who are never going to have to use their muscles.
And you don't make any literary connection between the displays of power abroad and that obsession with muscles at the gym?
No, that would be a kind of literary association. You know, science abhors metaphors and analogies. And writers should abhor them also.
Zbigniew Brzezinski, you though, I read, you're looking back to Oswald Spengler, who wrote, of course, after World War I. And you're describing how he saw the future of the West as the culmination of a process of political decay in which vital national culture devolves into an overly ambitious and increasingly Caesarian, as in Caesar, as in Rome, as in warlike civilization. And I hear you suggesting that you see that going on with the United States.
I'm concerned that we may be moving that way. And I'm struck, for example, by the fact that during the last several years, during the presidential campaign particularly, fear was used, or at least fear contributed to public and particularly political responses. There is a study in the magazine journal called Current Research in Social Psychology, which produces a lot of evidence, not anecdotal, but actual evidence, that there is evidence supporting the hypothesis that government-issued warnings led to increases in President Bush's approval ratings.
I mean, when all the color-coded stuff came out?
Yeah, whenever the coded stuff came up, the public opinion ratings went up. And former Secretary Ridge, for example, of Homeland Security, himself has publicly stated since leaving office that he was under pressure, political pressure, in effect, to pull up the ratings higher, the warnings higher.
So what's going on there?
Well, it seems to me that fear is being used, and with good effect. Don't forget that throughout the presidential campaign, the theme was, we are at war, and therefore we have to re-elect the commander-in-chief. Never mind that no one's being taxed more to pay for that war, particularly the rich. Never mind that no one is being asked to make any sacrifices, except for those who actually volunteer or have signed up for the reserves. Never mind that the commander-in-chief can take month-long vacations, but we are at war. The element of fear has been infused into American life.
You quote Spengler saying that creates conditions in which the manipulated people clamor for weapons and force their leaders into a conflict which they will, that is the leaders, to be forced.
Well, in fact, you know, public opinion supported the war in Iraq. There's no doubt about it, in that kind of atmosphere. And 9/11 and the fear that maybe Saddam has these weapons of mass destruction, and therefore maybe he'll give them somebody, and maybe they'll use them against us. So hurrah, let's go to war, and it was easy. Now, on students, I deal with students too, because I have a university connection. Yes, I think Tom made an excellent point that for many, the 9/11 event was essentially a kind of television theater. But at the same time, I sense something else among them, at least the ones I deal with, a kind of a concern as to where America's headed, what their future will be. Is this really going to remain the wealthiest, most prosperous, most democratic, most admired society in the world? Or are we likely to become increasingly isolated, the object of hatred, our policies despised in many parts of the world? And I think it's this kind of sense of misgiving, uncertainty, that I think is unfortunately quite widespread and dangerous to our future.
Tom Wolfe, you look at this from another angle pretty much entirely at points. You've written about George Bush's inaugural speech early this year and praised him for being in kind of line of descent from President Monroe, 1823, and the Monroe Doctrine. And you've looked at the corollaries added onto the Monroe Doctrine over the years and said, essentially, George Bush is just acknowledging that we now have a global planet. It's not just the Western Hemisphere that must be protected. You say the mission, the messianic mission, has never shrunk in the slightest, and you celebrate that. But how's that working out?
Well, for a start, I don't celebrate it.
Your trademark exclamation marks suggest to me that you did, but maybe not.
I'm not attacking. I was mainly proud of myself for making this discovery. But anyway, first, let me go back to something Spig said about the element of fear in the 2004 election. Hmm. Now, I am an extravagant admirer of Franklin D. Roosevelt. I was 15 years old when he died, and I thought America had somehow come to a tragic end. And you know, when I would see him on the altar with that cape, I said, God, this is a guy that's protecting us from everything. The same element of fear was injected into the 1944 election campaign. And it's something that happened that apparently is used by every president in the middle of a war. I mean, it's kind of...
Yeah, but we're not in a war. That's the whole point. It's a fiction.
Well, are we or not? Are we in a war, Zbigniew Brzezinski?
We're not. We are conducting a military campaign abroad with a minimum of domestic sacrifice, without any personal involvement by those in power. Can you name me any senior official of the Bush administration who has anyone overseas? This is not 1944. This is not a struggle for survival against a powerful, organized enemy. We're conducting a military campaign in Iraq. The president goes off in the middle of the so-called war for a month-long vacation, which is only interrupted because of domestic calamity. I mean, we are using these slogans for political purposes.
Tom Wolfe?
We are describing reality with them.
As FDR, I must say, tremendous.
FDR said, we have nothing to fear but fear itself.
He was always
I'm afraid this administration is creating fear and fears it.
Well, I would dispute them. Anyway, as I remember, Roosevelt was always in Hot Springs. Everything that happened, Roosevelt was in Hot Springs. And I did not begrudge him a minute of being in Hot Springs.
It's not he was dying at the time.
Well, we didn't know that then.
Yeah, but he knew it.
We didn't know that then.
But he knew it.
I don't think the government malfunctioned because he was in Hot Springs.
Yeah, Tom Wolfe, I want to come back.
We really were at war. By no stretch of the imagination can we compare our present circumstance with World War II.
Though it's been done often, and we've noted that. Tom Wolfe, I want to come back to the essay you wrote on the Monroe Doctrine. I don't want you to walk away quite so quickly.
I want to get into that.
You quote the President Bush from his inaugural speech saying, America's vital interests and our deepest beliefs are now one. From the day of our founding, we have proclaimed that every man and woman on this earth has rights and dignity and matchless value. And on he goes with a kind of global writ to set the world right. And I ask you, how do you think that project is going?
Well, may I just do a very, very quick thumbnail sketch of the Monroe Doctrine, how it applies right now. Monroe Doctrine was actually a bit of realpolitik under James Monroe and prodded by John Quincy Adams. And it said that no longer would we allow Europeans to colonize states in the Western Hemisphere. There were quite a few revolutionary movements, and we endorsed them, particularly in Chile. Argentina was one of them. Now, as years went by, that took on, you know, it was like an outrageous kind of thing to do because only Congress can wage war. But
bring us up to date. We've got 2 minutes before the break here, and I don't want to clip you off on it.
Teddy Roosevelt, in 1904, contributed a corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. He said, not only can no Europeans come here and colonize, but we're not going to put up with any nation in the Western Hemisphere that exhibits uncivilized behavior.
Yeah. Then comes George Kennan and the rest.
Well, actually, what comes next is Henry Cabot Lodge.
Yes.
Furthermore, you can't sell large bits of the Western Hemisphere to foreign powers. I mean, that was really quite an addition.
And now you see George Bush taking that global, and Mr. Big Brzezinski says the world hates us. So
wait a minute. But now the concept of hemisphere doesn't mean anything any longer.
Yeah.
It used to be that there was this vast bodies of water between us and Europe and Asia had some strategic meaning. They have much less now with jet airplanes, with rocket powered missiles.
And so does that make us the old idealist or the American Caesar?
Well, I think it is an extension of the Monroe. Why did we go into Kosovo? Which is something that would puzzle me at the time. Why did we go into Bosnia? Why did we go into Somalia, for God's sake? Nobody was shouting against that. And that was really an extension of the Monroe Doctrine.
And now we're a little deeper than that. We have to take a break, and forgive me, Tom Wolf, Zbigniew Brzezinski. We're talking about America, the psyche, the security situation since 9/11. You can join us. How would you describe America's evolution since 9/11/2001? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We've been keeping a lot of callers waiting. We will turn to them. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services in Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist Tom Wolf and security chieftain, former presidential security advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski, about America and American foreign policy 4 years after 9/11. You can join the conversation. Are we safer, better off than we were 4 years ago, than we were on 9/11/2001? We're at 1-800-423-8255, and we appreciate our callers' patience. Let me begin to turn to them. Caitlin is calling from Boston. Hi, Caitlin. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
There's a couple points I just wanted to make. One is I think that you should very quickly look at the 2004 elections, and the voters in Washington and New York voted 9-1 against George Bush.
What do you take from that?
Well, the people who certainly should be most fearful, and I was in Washington then, have a different fear. And I think the blue people of this country, if you will, fear that this country won't change, that we will never see what we could become, especially under this administration.
Won't change in what direction? Won't change and lose what opportunity?
Won't change for the better. I think that we could become an inclusive, open, equal society, and that people who voted red were voting because they were afraid that what we have now would become worse. And if I can just quickly also say that Mr. Wolf had said that September 11th was inexplicable. And I think that feeds into fear. That when we say, September 11th was gut-wrenching. It was deplorable. It was evil. But it is not inexplicable. To say that makes us stand here and say that we can be so fearful because there's no reason that this happened. There is no cause behind it, even if it is a bad cause that we were a part of doing wrong.
Caitlin, we've got it, and let us pick it up. And if I may turn first to Zbigniew Brzezinski here, you talk about this tension between idealism and the security response, and you say we're not getting the balance right. Caitlin wants more idealism, wants more inclusiveness, wants more openness. Is that airy-fairy or is that vital?
Well, I think it's vital, but I also think she makes a very good point in saying that there is, in fact, a reality behind terrorism that we have to face up to, and we cannot address the issue of terrorism in a state of denial, merely maintaining vaguely that the reason the terrorists come after us is that they hate freedom, that they hate our culture, that they are religiously motivated, and so forth. All of these factors do play a role, but the fact is, terrorism against the United States is related to the Middle Eastern problem, to the dilemmas of the Middle East, and to the fact that the United States, right or wrong, plays the role in the Middle East now that the British were playing earlier, and that the United States is deeply involved in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and more partial to Israel. And whether one likes these policies or not, the fact is they create animus. And it's not an accident that the terrorists come from the Middle East. It's not an accident that the objects of terrorism have been countries associated with us in the pursuit of our policies in the Middle East. This is not an argument for abandoning these policies or for altering them entirely, but it is for facing up to the fact that terrorism is largely a political challenge in response to the politics, the policies that we have been pursuing.
Tom Wolfe, what do you make of that description of the taproot of terror? And what about our caller Caitlin's view that the country needs more idealism, not less?
Well, first of all, let me say, when I said it was inexplicable, at that moment, I think there was no one could figure out the scope of the attack. They did. Nobody knew whether there were yet more weaponry at the disposal of Al Qaeda. We didn't even know it was Al Qaeda at first. It was a moment of tremendous confusion. Although you can go back and say, "Well, the CIA knew this and they knew that." Going on to Caitlin mentioned the blue states. How the New York was 9-1 against Bush, and Washington was 9-1. Believe me, 9/11 was the least of the factors in that election. You know, we call them the blue states. They're really the parenthesis states. And it's like a sentence with the parenthesis at either end. The meat of the sentence is between the parentheses.
You're talking about the middle of the country.
I'm talking about the middle of the country. If you call it the middle from the Hudson River to
the great middle, then
to Boyle Heights in Los Angeles. And also, are we really less idealistic? What other country in the world would allow a foreign people, different in language, different in culture, in many cases different in color from the native stock, take over a metropolis within half a generation and rule it politically? I'm talking about the Cubans in Miami. It couldn't have happened. Right now, there's not a single Algerian on the Paris City Council. There's one Turk, one in the German Parliament. And in this country, if you've got the votes, if you have the modicum of organization, you're going to take political power. This is the most idealistic country on the face of the earth and has been ever since 1776.
Let me get another call here. Randy's calling from Augusta, Georgia. Hi, Randy. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I couldn't agree more with Mr. Brzezinski. My major point was that the media has jumped on this bandwagon. If you look at CNN or Fox, I mean, not trying to single any out, but there's always that ticker, yellow elevated. Nothing has happened in this country for 4 years, yet everybody is buying into keeping this fear up. Our government wants to keep the fear up because it gives them more power. We sacrifice our freedoms because we're afraid of somebody hurting us when there's very little actual danger of that. The rest of the world has learned how to deal with this.
And you feel the fear fanned right there in the media, and we've got it. Randy, thanks for your call. We've just got a couple of minutes left here. A couple things. One, first to you, Zbigniew Brzezinski, you say the United States is facing a new kind of global populism where everybody judges everyone, including the superpower, and it's losing the battle for that judgment of the world's consensus on whether or not we're a worthy super leader. So what's to be done about that?
Well, first of all, let me just say that what the caller said, I very much agree with. I listen to the CBS News every morning here in Washington, and almost every day, so a new so-called terrorism expert is on the air evoking some new idea of a horrible, horrible event that we have to anticipate. Mm. The mass media have certainly jumped on the terror wagon because it's news, it sells. It's like something interesting.
And the global popularity vote, we just got a minute. Does it matter? Do we have to win it?
On the global popularity issue, I think the United States has to return to what it has always been, namely an inspiration, an example, a country that promotes genuine freedom and cooperation with others, and is sensitive to the interests of others in terms of their dignity,
political, religious, and national. We have become insensitive to that in many respects. And this is why our policies abroad today, others are not following. It isn't just that they're jealous of us. They really think our policies are short-sighted and counterproductive, even to our long-term future.
And Tom Wolf, we're in our last minute. What do you make of Iraq? What do you take away from what's going on, what's happened there?
Well, I'll just first say, Zbig mentioned challenge to freedoms. I just think that simply hasn't occurred. I mean, it's still the freest nation on the face of the earth. Now, going on to the long term, it could be, I was even talking in Hartford, Connecticut, mm-hmm. before 9/11, I was asked about the invasion of Iraq by someone who obviously expected me to snigger and tell them how stupid George Bush is. That's the atmosphere in such places. I said then, and I say it again now, the jury is out. History will decide whether this was a wise move or not. If somehow democracy is brought to the Middle East, then he'll be considered one of the most successful, daring presidents of all time. If it really does become a kind of a Vietnam where you have to retreat in ignominy, he won't. He'll be considered one of the worst. But it was a very bold move, and history will make the decision.
Tom Wolf, suspending judgment for the moment. Zbigniew Brzezinski, ready to pass some judgments. I want to thank you both. It's been a fascinating hour, and we're grateful to you for being with us. Tom Wolf in New York, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Tom, and it's a great joy. My status has been immensely enhanced by being on the program with you, Zbigniew.
It's been really nice to be with you, Tom. In fact, we're both Toms. Thank you for having me.
Wonderful. Zbigniew Brzezinski, National Security Advisor under President Jimmy Carter, and Tom Wolf, author most recently of I Am Charlotte Simmons. Thanks to both of you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I want to turn now to Hanover, New Hampshire, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. On Point was born out of the chaos and dismay, the emergency coverage of 9/11, and Jack's been thinking a bit about that. Jack, thanks for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure, Tom. The main job of journalism is to orient the public mind to reality. And reality is hard to find sometimes, and it's not a certain, it's not like bedrock, it's not like you find it and then you put a stake in it. It's a search, and you judge news institutions on really how well they do that. And, you know, there was a study, everyone cited it at the time, done out of the University of Maryland in 2003 about misconceptions about the Iraq War. And there were three of them that they singled out. One was, you know, that the U.S. had found weapons of mass destruction there. And it was a poll of 9,000 people. And they figured out how many people had one or another of these three misconceptions, and then they went to the sources of news. Where'd you get your news from which you could derive this misconception? And they rated these news sources according to, you know, how they stacked up there. And, you know, they found that 80% of Fox viewers believed one or another of them, 71% of CBS News viewers believed, and they went on down the list. Only 23% of those who relied mainly on National Public Radio or the Corporation for Public Broadcasting believed any one of these three shared any one of these three misconceptions.
They're a feather in the cap that matters after these years.
Well, I really think it does. I mean, and these weren't controversial misconceptions. These are, you know, things that even the Bush administration says are wrong. So I think our show made a contribution to that, and this network has made a contribution to that.
Something to be proud of as we note that very small anniversary that sits next to the huge anniversary looming this Sunday, September 11th. Jack Beatty, it's been a pleasure through these years, and I look forward to more. Thanks very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
In a moment, a 9/11 father reaches out to Hurricane Katrina victims. This is On Point. Around the country, Americans are opening their hearts, their homes, their wallets, and doing whatever they can to help victims of Hurricane Katrina. Among those reaching out are families of those who died on 9/11/2001. As they prepare to mark the fourth anniversary of their loss, they're mobilizing to help those hit by Katrina. William Doyle, who lost his son Joseph in the World Trade Center on 9/11, is one of those reaching out. In this radio diary, he talks about his son and about helping those affected by the nation's latest disaster.
On 9/11 itself, I was watching TV. It was the news station that has stocks and bonds, whatever, and that should be in a stock trader. Or, you know, I was watching it, and they broke it and said a plane hit the Tower 1. And immediately, one of the MCs over there jumped on. He says, "We just got a call from a trader across the street that says Cantor Fitzgerald was devastated." My wife and I looked at us. I refused to believe that Joey was gone. And she started screaming, he's murdered, you know, he's dead, we're never going to get him back. And then we had so many false hopes from different people calling us and saying that Joey's okay, on emails from different people for days on end. And he turned up on a live list. On that Friday, I actually got a phone call from someone that said that he's seen Joey. And I had so many people checking all triages and going to all hospitals and what have you. I wanted to believe that he's still out there somewhere, or mentally incapable, or you know, just really badly physically injured. That wasn't the case, obviously. Last week, when Katrina happened, the families themselves, the 9/11 families, could share that grief and the pain that these people are going to go through. And it's not going to be a 3 to 6 month type of thing. These people are going to be going through a lot of situations for a long time. 9/11 families are still going through it. They contacted me. So many people sent me emails. "Bill, you got to start a foundation." And that's where I am right now, because so many of the family members want to give it back. And the reason being is because they share the grief and the pain that those people are going through. Amazingly, we just announced a foundation, and we only did it last Saturday or Sunday. And it's called the 9/11 Families for Katrina Relief. And I sent it out to the families, asking where to send donations. It's to 2631 Highland Boulevard in Staten Island, New York. It's 10306. And what occurred, I guess because of the power of email, I started getting emails from Houston, from Mississippi, Alabama. And it's amazing to see how many 9/11 people are actually down in places like Meridian, Mississippi. He called me. He said, "Bill, you can't call me, but listen, this is what's needed now." He drove from New York to Meridian, Mississippi. He lost his son on 9/11 at Windows of the World. And he's down there helping. Then I had another family member call me from Houston, Texas. Okay, in Texas themselves, there are about 6 or 7 families, 9/11 families, that live down there. They're all part of the effort of helping those people that are over in that Astrodome. It's amazing to watch the 9/11 families, how they'll help anyone, because, like I said, I think they can share the grief and the pain and what's going to happen to these people and the problems that they're going to have over the course of many years.
William Doyle lives on Staten Island, New York. His son, Joseph Doyle, worked in the World Trade Center's North Tower for Cantor Fitzgerald. He was 25 years old. We leave you this hour with music composed by the father of another American lost on 9/11. Daryl Bodley wrote this piece in memory of his daughter, Diora, who died on 9/11/2001 at age 20 when American Airlines Flight 93 crashed into a field in Pennsylvania. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.